Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What are the prospects today for peace between India and Pakistan? Last week, Islamic extremists with apparent ties to Pakistan opened fire in several locations in Mumbai, killing more than 170 people and wounding hundreds more. Now, leaders on both sides of that border are trying to balance the demands of international diplomacy with the critical need for domestic stability. U.S. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice is calling for Pakistan to act swiftly and severely to punish terrorist groups that are responsible, while also urging India not to act in haste against its neighbor. Whether both sides can stay on that tightrope without either one pulling the other into all-out war remains to be seen. Here to offer some insight into the delicate and dangerous situation is Kamran Bukhari. He is Director of Middle East Analysis for the Austin-based private intelligence company Stratfor. Kamran, welcome to Think.
Thank you for having me.
The horrible irony of this is that state-to-state relations between India and Pakistan had been somewhat improved recently. Can you talk about how the two governments had been sort of working together?
In the aftermath of the last crisis, which took place in 2001-2002, when the same group, Lashkar-e-Taiba, that's being accused of being the mastermind behind the Mumbai attacks, staged an attack on the Indian Parliament in Delhi, and that led to a crisis situation with both countries massing their troops on the border, and ultimately the countries backed away from what could easily be a nuclear war. Since then, the Indians and Pakistanis have had an unprecedented warming of relations, people-to-people contact, confidence-building measures, a lot of traffic back and forth in between the two countries. And I mean, from what I hear from the generals that in Pakistan is that there was this hope that, you know, we could probably put the past behind us, especially with former President Pervez Musharraf basically pushing and driving this peace initiative. But since then, especially because the deteriorating domestic situation in Pakistan, this process seems derailed.
Has it completely erased the gains, do you think?
Well, if you're going to ask me whether there will be war between India and Pakistan, I would say the chances are pretty strong. But then again, I mean, the same thing was being said back in 2001, 2002. Now, granted, this is a much larger attack than what happened in 2001. So I think that for the foreseeable future, the gains that were made in the last few years, they have been pretty much lost.
So you've talked about the relative weakness of the Pakistani government. Maybe you can elaborate that on that a little bit, and why Pakistan, whether or not the will is there, has had an incredibly hard time getting control over these non-state actors that are causing trouble in India and elsewhere.
Well, it goes back to the way former President Pervez Musharraf dealt with or ruled the country in the wake of the 9/11 attacks and the pressure from the United States to help against al-Qaeda and the Taliban. And that meant, for Pakistan, that meant reversing state policy that was in motion for at least a quarter of a century, i.e. backing the Taliban. The Pakistanis helped with al-Qaeda, but they were not willing to help with the Taliban, and they're hoping that, you know, we could secure the Kashmiri militant, Islamist militant assets that they could use against India at some future point in time. Obviously, they had to freeze everything in the wake of 9/11. That has led, they created a tension within the state, and the state is the army of Pakistan. I mean, granted, we have civilian forces and a very robust democratic undercurrent in the country, but at the end of the day, it's the army that's the glue that holds the country together. And that glue seems to be coming apart because of the internal schisms between those saying that, you know, we need to move away from backing these actors, and they're being opposed by those who say, no, we can't give these people up because that's our only line of defense against India. And, of course, a lot of the elements within the intelligence establishment at the lower levels have also been engaged in rogue operations that are not necessarily authorized by the top leadership. So this has really pulled the country into two different directions, and then the army's hold over the state has been weakened. And plus, Musharraf, he fell from power because he was faced with two crises. One, a jihadist insurgency in the country, the very people that Islamabad cultivated for so many years turned their guns against the state, and then the lawyers' movement after Musharraf dismissed the Chief Justice. So both of those trends basically weakened the state, and now we're looking at a state that really doesn't have a whole lot of control over its territory, which is clear from the Mumbai attacks. I mean, these people did come from Pakistan. The evidence is mounting in those terms. So, yes, I mean, we're looking at a very weak state not being able to establish its writ over its territory.
Kamran Bukhari is my guest. He's director of Middle East analysis for the private intelligence firm Stratfor, which is based in Austin. We're talking about relationships between India and Pakistan in the wake of the November 26th attacks in Mumbai. India, at least initially, Kamran, said there were not plans to boost troop strength along the border with Pakistan. Do you expect that to change?
Well, it doesn't look like Pakistan can satisfy Indian demands. I mean, the demands are such that, you know, it would create, it comes with a cost to Pakistan domestically, create a bigger problem for the Pakistani government and the army at home if they were to give in to the Indian demands. So that means that we're not really left with many options, and then the Indians are likely to amass troops at the bare minimum. And this is something that they did back in 2001, 2002 as well. I mean, this is the amassing of the troops. The question is whether we're going to see a conflict with India exercising the military option to take action against these elements. There's been talk of carrying out airstrikes against militant facilities, particularly in the Pakistani-administered Kashmir, where many of these people have bases and facilities.
Do you think that is there the option for Pakistan to try and do some of the things that India wants without compromising stability? Does it really have to take one line or the other? Is there a way for it to sort of go halfway?
It's not inevitable, but it's a difficult balancing act. I mean, you have to understand that while there is that civil-military divide. I mean, the army would like to have a final say on what Pakistan does, and the government is obviously trying to deal with it from a political angle. So there's a disconnect between the army and the government. And then there's a schism within the army. There are two types of schools of thought that are emerging that say, you know, the Islamist militant actors are bad and we need to deal with these people. And then there are those who say that, you know, sure, there are bad ones, but there are also good ones who don't attack us. Why are we throwing the baby with the bathwater? So there is that. So the question is for the Pakistan Army, how do you go after the bad militants while retaining control over the quote-unquote good ones?
So what about third-party countries, including the United States? What can be done to sort of strengthen Pakistan's ability to get control over its own country?
We see the United States taking a very active role in this emerging crisis. We have two very senior U.S. officials, U.S. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice and Joint Chiefs of Staff Admiral Michael Mullen, both visiting the region and going to both countries and trying to come up with some sort of a negotiated settlement that can avoid conflict. But ultimately, there's not much that the United States can do for three different reasons. One is that the U.S. is in a period of transition itself. I mean, Washington is moving from a Bush administration to an incoming Obama administration. So there's not a whole lot of influence that the outgoing Bush administration has over both parties. Secondly, India has never really subordinated its foreign policy decision-making process to the United States or anybody else. I mean, they've maintained a very independent line. So it's not as if, I'll try to make an analogy here, it's not as if the United States is trying to rein in Israel not to attack Iran because it could complicate things in Iraq. I mean, that the Israelis are far more willing to listen to the United States, whereas the Indians, they don't operate on those in those terms. So there's that. And then the third is, you know, there's not much that the Pakistanis can do. I mean, the U.S. also realizes that there are limitations into what the Pakistanis can deliver. Because of their internal chaos, they don't have their own house in order. So what is promised by the government or the military may not materialize.
So ultimately, does Islamabad perceive a greater threat to its survival from domestic instability than from out-and-out war with India?
Yes. Domestic instability is seen as the bigger evil. But this is something, I mean, this is in the nature of the Pakistani state, that if you have an attack from India, I mean, you have to set aside everything else. And theoretically, that's what the Pakistanis are hoping will happen, because that's what's happened in the past. But there's a huge difference between the past and the present. In the past, there was a far more robust state. The army was all in all and was able to galvanize the country and deal with the external threat. This time around, the domestic situation is as such that the army can't make those claims.
And what happens to India if Pakistan spins out of control domestically?
See, that's a huge problem for the Indian government, and that's probably why they are engaged in heavy debate, and there's a lot of reluctance in terms of which option to go for. I mean, right now, Pakistan serves as a buffer that protects India. I mean, that sort of keeps the chaos that's in Afghanistan and is now slowly creeping into Pakistan on that side of the border, on to the west of Pakistan. So if Pakistan is to experience Afghanistan-like conditions, then that's right smack on the Indian border, and that's a major security threat. So the Indians are concerned that, you know, sure, we have this major terrorist attack that's taken place, and we are being forced to respond, primarily because we have a domestic political situation with the elections coming up, and then also because we don't know. I mean, this could just be a precedent. If we don't attack right now or make counter moves, then this sets a precedent for future attacks. So they're being forced to take a hard-line stance, but nonetheless, they're also worried that, you know, we don't want to end up creating a situation where we would we'd basically ultimately defeat the purpose of taking action, because if we're worried about a Mumbai attack right now, what if Pakistan descends into chaos? Then we're looking at a bigger mess that will spill over into our areas, because we share a very long border.
Do you think, though, that the upcoming elections will actually push Indian leaders to be more nationalistic and more ideological in the way they deal with this, as opposed to being more pragmatic, which in the long run would seem to win them more praise from the Indian people? But we all know elections have strange impact on how people make their decisions.
The ruling Congress-led coalition government, the Congress Party, has long been criticized for being, by the opposition, for being, you know, soft on terrorism, quote unquote. And so Congress has to demonstrate that that is not the case, especially now. I mean, in the past, we haven't. This attack is significant because it's very different in terms of size and magnitude than what we've seen in recent years. I mean, mostly what we have seen are command detonated IEDs. I mean, going off in multiple places, people getting killed, but ultimately nothing really major that would trigger India to say, you know, let me take action against Pakistan. And it didn't disrupt the peace process that was going on, or the normalization of relations. This time around, that's not the case. This is basically something that you cannot ignore. So Congress has to say, you know, we have to demonstrate that, you know, we have things under control, and we can take the tough actions when the need arises. And therefore, it has to behave in a much more tough fashion than what it has in the past. If they don't, they will lose the election. And regardless of who wins the election, ultimately, I mean, any Indian government, whether it's Congress-led or led by the right-wing Bharatiya Janata Party that's more hawkish, they have to deal with this in a strong way, because
Kamran Bakari is my guest. We've got to take a quick break. We'll be back in just a minute. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program, offering flexible part-time graduate study. You can follow your passion at SMU, and you can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
Thank you. You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're talking this hour about the relationship between India and Pakistan in the wake of last week's terrorist attacks in Mumbai. My guest is Kamran Bukhari. He is Director of Middle East Analysis for Stratfor. It's a private intelligence company based in Austin. If you want to join our conversation, you can send email to think@kera.org or you can call 1-800-933-5372. You were saying before the break, Kamran, that regardless of the outcome of the elections, this is going to have to be dealt with on the Indian side.
Yes, I mean, let's say that for some reason Congress loses the election. Even if the BJP came into power, it's not the end of it. I mean, then they will be coming into power on a mandate that this party, when it will govern more effectively, and especially will be tough on terror, and will take the steps that are necessary. They'll be even under more pressure because they would have built up a momentum during the elections. And that momentum is already building because the Indian public has reacted in a very strong way, not just specifically against Pakistan, but more significantly against politicians in general. There is an outrage against politicians on the streets of Mumbai and other major cities, saying that, government is into politics. And the political parties are just playing politics with such tragedies. So both parties are under a lot of pressure to do something.
And there's also been a lot of pressure on the Indian government to have protected people better. To what extent is the security failure in India going to play into the election?
It will play a huge role because if you look at what was happening in the past, I mean, right before the Mumbai attacks, whenever there would be an attack, the Indian authorities would go after the people who they suspect of being the perpetrators and take down the cells. What they were not able to do is take down the network. Hence, after every attack, there would be arrests, but then that would be followed up by another attack. That was the situation up until Mumbai. Now, with this latest attack, everything is off the charts. In fact, if the question in the mind of the Indian voter and in the average Indian is that, you were already in a state of alert, you knew that there were attacks going to happen, how could you let this slip? I mean, so in other words, the idea is that this is a massive intelligence failure. And the way that the Indian security forces dealt with the standoff, I mean, it took like 60 hours to take control over all the target sites. So that says a lot about the ability of Indian security forces to deal in counterinsurgency and counterterrorism operations. So there'll be a lot of questions asked, and there'll be a lot of pressure on the government to deliver on those fronts.
This has widely been labeled India's 9/11, not just here in the United States, but in fact within India. A lot of newspapers have used that phrase. Is that a helpful comparison, and does it in fact tell us anything about the response that we can expect from India?
It's very helpful in terms of the response that we're about to see. I mean, if you look at how this has become an international issue, and a crisis in which two top U.S. officials of an outgoing administration have been rushed to the region, and that says a lot about where this crisis is going and its magnitude. I mean, we've not seen anything like this in India. Like I said, in the past, Islamist militants were only able to set off bombs. Of course, there were simultaneous attacks in various areas, but nothing like this. This shows an enhanced capability on the part of the Islamist militants and a failure on the part of the state. So yes, the Indians, if the Indians can't deal with this in the form of a law enforcement or an intelligence in intelligence terms, then of course they have to do something internationally, and they have to do, because of the evidence that is emerging points to Pakistan. They know that no matter what they do at home, they will always be faced with a problem of people trying to do stuff from outside. And then there's a lot of, resentment within the Indian Muslim community that the people from outside, the masterminds, will be able to find people to help them perpetrate these attacks. In these circumstances, the Indian government has to do something on a much larger scale than just take some simple domestic action.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. My guest is Kamran Bukhari. He is Director of Middle East Analysis for Stratfor. Let's speak to Mickey in Southlake. Hello, Mickey.
Yes, hi. Yes.
Hi.
Very good, I would say good show, but, you know, this is, I come from India, so just a comment and a question. Like your guest, I guess he said earlier that, you know, India wouldn't be going to war with Pakistan since, you know, there's a lot of, you know, they're already unstable, and they've been unstable. There's been, you know, military governments there. My comment is it, I guess it's time for, you know, Pakistan maybe to clean up, you know, their act from inside out. And your guest said, you know, something about good militant and bad militant. I guess he was saying, like, you know, good ones are the ones that don't attack you back, but save you from, you know, kind of India and, you know, I guess that's what he was saying. But what is the... Is there, now we live in post 9/11 era, I guess, and the U.S. is sending, you know, Secretary of State and, you know, people over there. Is there a solution, do you think? Can Pakistan be pushed in some way so that they try to clean this up? And I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks for your call. I guess it comes back again, Kamran, to the issue of pressure domestically and pressure internationally.
Yes, to answer the question, I mean, the good and the bad I was referring to is how the Pakistanis see it. I mean, that's sort of their view. It was for a very long time, it was used for the Taliban. Those Taliban that were fighting NATO and U.S. forces were seen as good Taliban. Then those forces, the Taliban that were acting on this side of the border in, against Pakistan and engaging in suicide bombings, were the bad Taliban. So that's just not limited to the Taliban. It's also limited to other actors, Kashmiri militants. I mean, some of whom have gone rogue, some of whom are still under the control of Islamabad. So there's that. As far as Pakistan being able to clean up its act, one thing is very telling. I mean, President Musharraf from 2001, right after September 11, all the way up until the spring of 2007, was very much fully in control of the situation in the country. He was very powerful. He faced no challenges whatsoever. And he was not able to clean up the system, even though he saw and understood. I've personally spoken with him on a number of occasions, and I knew that there was a desire on his part. But he was the head of the military, and he's worked in that institution for a very long time. And he knew what the weaknesses and the strengths of the Pakistan Army are. So he obviously wasn't able to make a whole lot of progress. You reshuffle a few people from the top, hoping that, you know, there will be change, there will be reform. But ultimately, I mean, this is a system that's decaying from within. I mean, if you have rogue actors who are not listening to the hierarchy or are doing things on their own and have one foot in the camp of Al-Qaeda and the transnational elements and one foot in the state, I mean, that's a pretty bad situation. The question is, how do you fix that? I mean, that calls for a radical overhaul, and that requires a very strong state. Unfortunately, right now, the Pakistani state is anything but strong.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak next to Raji in Dallas. Hi, Raji.
Hi. My comment is, have we reached a point where the international community and India can conclude that the Pak state, and by that I mean the army and the ISI and the civilian government, whatever control it has, are they in a position by which they can stop supporting the terrorists that perpetrate terrorist attacks around the world, or are they incapable of that? The question is, like as in Nazi Germany, were the Germans capable of peacefully removing the Nazi regime? Were the Afghanis capable of peacefully removing the Taliban, which was supporting the Al-Qaeda? Were those changes peacefully possible? And I think it is a very pessimistic scenario. I don't think it is peacefully now possible to dissociate the Pak state from the militants it has supported on various occasions and continues to do so. I will. That was my comment, and I will wait for the answer.
Thanks very much for your call.
Thanks.
Kamran, what do you think?
Well, I think that in order to change the direction of things, and in order to for the Pakistani state to deal and clean house, it requires pretty much a civil war of sorts. I mean, in many ways, that civil war is already underway with the suicide bombings and the insurgency that's taking place in the country. It requires a leadership that is saying, you know, this is something we have to do, and so we have to cut our losses and take those tough steps so that we can, I mean, in the words of one official who I spoke to yesterday, that, you know, in order to save the body, we need to cut off one part. We need to be ready to sacrifice one part. Now, the question is the leadership, is there a consensus within the civil military leadership that, you know, this is something that we should do and that we must do? I think that there's a lack of consensus. There's clearly a lack of consensus. So what that means is that you won't see a whole lot of progress on that front. And, I mean, the other thing, in all fairness to those who do have the intent in Pakistan to turn things around, they are facing with so many problems that they're overwhelmed. I mean, this is a country that just doesn't have, like, a security problem. I mean, this is a country that just took out a $7.6 billion loan and still needs pretty much the same amount to be able to reboot its economic system. This is a country that's faced with deteriorating relations with the United States, its main historical ally. It has problems on both Western and now the Eastern border. There is political chaos in the country. So there's pretty much anything that can bad happen to this country is happening. So we're faced with not just any problem on the level of intent, but capability.
We have sort of a related question from GK, who writes, like Afghanistan and Lebanon, Pakistan has large areas that escape its control, where militias are essentially states within the state. How do you help such countries? Do you strengthen the central government, or do you strengthen civil society through economic aid?
Well, I mean, if you're dealing with militants, clearly helping civil society won't help, because you can't do development work if you're being shot at. Mm-hmm. And civil society groups are not designed to engage in combat with militias. And that's the job of the state. So theoretically, you need to help the state. But it's not that simple, as we've seen. I mean, it's a much more convoluted, complicated process. And if this is going to be successful, it's going to take time.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Bubita in Fort Worth. Hi.
Hello. I have a question for your guest. Why did the chief minister of Maharashtra, Deshmukh, resign along with R.R. Patil so much quickly after the attack in Mumbai?
Kamran?
Well, I mean, clearly the elections are coming. So you have a massive failure on the part of the Maharashtra government. I mean, Mumbai is in Maharashtra, so it's the job of the state government to make sure these things don't happen. And then the way this was handled was also criticized. So it's only natural that he resigns in the hope of salvaging his political future in the coming elections.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We're talking with the Director of Middle East Analysis for STRATFOR, Kamran Bukhari. You can also send email this afternoon to think@kera.org. Let's go next to John in Dallas. Hi, John.
Hi, yes. I just had a comment, I guess, or just you can offer your guest. I'm driving in the car, so I don't have the exact references, but I've come across some blogs remember, there was an article on Russia Today, it's online, saying there was maybe some influences from Russia or Chechen influences in the style of the attacks. That might not necessarily be Pakistani influences. There might be other things like that coming into play. And part of it maybe too, since Mumbai was such a financial center, to partially unstabilize the United States, and might even have ties into peak oil. And I'll take comments off the air. Thanks.
Thanks for your call. Had you heard anything about a potential Russian influence on at least the way that the attacks were executed?
It's difficult to say, but what we do know is that, you know, tactics, approaches, MOs used by Islamist militants in a certain part of the world, say the Caucasus in Chechnya, are obviously duplicated in other parts. I mean, this is a sort of a feeding off of the experience of others. That happens very often, so therefore you'll see the similarities in the attacks of Mumbai with what happened against the U.S. consulate in Jeddah a few years ago in Saudi Arabia, what recently happened against the U.S. embassy in Yemen. So, yeah, I mean, so there is and the bombing of the Serena Hotel in Kabul. So there is a sharing of it, and that's why we think that this is not the work of, or this is not only the Indian Islamist militant groups being behind this attack. There are several other elements that have made this possible, and one of them is the Transnational Jihadist Network, which is, I mean, headquartered in Pakistan, and hence the reference to Pakistan, and hence why Pakistan is in the hot seat.
We're talking to Kamran Bakari. He is director of Middle East Analysis for Stratfor. It's a private intelligence company based in Austin. Our conversation this afternoon is about relations between India and Pakistan in the wake of the November 26th attacks in Mumbai, what they might mean moving forward. Moving forward after this break, we will take more of your calls. You can join us by phone at 1-800-933-5372, or if the lines are full, you can send an email to think@kera.org. Back in a minute.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program, offering flexible part-time graduate study. You can follow your passion at SMU, and you can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Director of Middle East Analysis for Stratfor. It's a private intelligence firm based in Austin. His name is Kamran Bakari. You can join the conversation by sending email to think@kera.org. Can you talk for just a minute, Kamran, about the significance of the targets, not just Mumbai, but wealthy Mumbai?
Yes. I mean, unlike the past in which the militants, when they staged bombings, it was directed towards the Hindu community, attacking their temples, neighborhoods, community centers. This attack is very different. You have an attack on hotels, which are not just frequented by locals, but by wealthy foreigners, I mean, executives of major corporations. And you have an attack on they don't want to completely focus on the international aspect, and they want, so they struck it at a railway station, and they struck it at theaters and hospitals. So this attack was, and this is why we think that, you know, based on the target set, this is why we think that there are a number of players involved here. The enhanced capability or training for this obviously came from transnational elements who have an interest in targeting Jews, Israelis, and Westerners, and, of course, the locals who have an interest in targeting the Indian government and Indian targets. So it was a coordination in which the outsiders likely brought in the capability, enhanced the capability of the locals. Clearly, neither can function on its own and pull off such an attack. The foreigners need the insider help, and the insiders need the foreign help for this kind of a magnitude. So that is why the you saw that for the first time, Islamist militants in India attacking Westerners. Until now, they've not shown any interest in doing so.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Ruhi in Dallas. Hi, Ruhi.
Hi.
Hi, go ahead, please.
What I wanted to ask was that, is it really possible that we can get to the root of this without addressing the Kashmir issue, without addressing the water, entry of water into Pakistan, where the Indians are stopping the rivers from flowing easily through Pakistan, and also the deprivation of the Muslims within India? This is, to me, even if it's outside influences, all these things are going to constantly feed these people, so that the attacks are not going to stop unless the root causes are dealt with.
Thanks for your call.
Well, I mean, here's the thing. I mean, I think we're talking about two separate things here. One is terrorism. I mean, clearly, if there are people who have already in a stage where they're about to attack or they will continue to attack, then you need to deal with them on a different level than you would be dealing with disaffection by large swaths of population, extremism in general. That can be dealt with in sort of non-security means. I mean, you can engage them in dialogue. You can engage in development work. You can sit down and sort out the issues and try to come to some sort of a negotiated settlement. But with people who are already staging attacks, who've crossed the line from simple disaffection or extremism over to just blatant terrorism, I mean, you have people picking up the gun, strapping themselves with bombs, or engaging in the type of behavior that we saw in Mumbai, those have to be dealt with separately. And the dynamics are as such that you can't talk about root causes in the short term. I agree that ultimately that unless you deal with the root causes, you're not going to completely do away with this phenomenon. And then, of course, there's the question of, can you ever completely get rid of such violence? But, of course, it can be minimized, but that's a long-term thing. In the short term, you have to deal with it through the use of force, whether it is domestically or whether it is the way the United States waged the war on terror in the wake of 9/11 attacks.
Do you expect, Kamran, that given the, at least from the perspective of the people who carried these out, the success of these attacks in getting a great deal of attention, do you expect there will be more attacks like the one we just saw in Mumbai?
Clearly, I mean, this is something that the perpetrators and their supporters feel has been a major success, and it has boosted their confidence, and they're likely to engage in follow-up attacks, maybe not immediately, because they also know that, you know, there will be a backlash, and they have to prepare for that. And there's also, I mean, just like Al-Qaeda incurred a lot of a loss of assets and facilities in the wake of the 9/11 attacks, these people are bracing for that counterstrike. But at a sort of a level of, at a psychological level, yes, this has emboldened these people. And they feel that, you know, we can basically create waves. I mean, it is our goal of setting up some regional Islamist state is not something that's beyond the pale. If we can create a regional crisis, an international crisis like this, then our ultimate goal may not be that far off.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak next to Leslie in Fort Worth. Hi.
Hi. I had a question that sort of goes back to something that was being discussed earlier about Pakistan's sort of political system needing to move into a different direction in the future. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering what your take is on how Benazir Bhutto's assassination affected the ability of Pakistan to move in a different direction, or maybe a very different direction in the future politically. And I'll be happy to take my answer off the air.
Thanks for your call.
Thanks.
Yes, I mean, Benazir Bhutto her assassination was significant in terms of how the political future of Pakistan will unfold, because she was one of a kind. I mean, in the sense that her stature, there was nobody who could say, you know, I'm co-equal to Benazir Bhutto. So in that sense, she had a lot of influence over not just her party. She was the leader of the most popular party, and her death has actually weakened the party. There are a lot of internal schisms, and there are a lot of factional fighting that her successor and her widower, Asif Ali Zardari, the current president, is unable to maintain for very long because he just doesn't have the same caliber, the charisma. So yes, I mean, from that point of view, that her death has damaged the prospects. But then again, I mean, this is a state that has not really seen civilian rule. With the exception of Benazir Bhutto's father, former Prime Minister Zulfikar Ali Bhutto, we've not seen any strong civilian leader. The army is the state here. I mean, the army is the one that is the only institution that has, until very recently, been the most disciplined and robust body that has kept the state together. So if that institution is wavering now, is weakening, then, I mean, what can be said of, civilians? I mean, civilians really don't have a whole lot of influence in the country.
An email from Rick in Frisco asks, is this the first terrorist attack since 9/11 where the two key countries involved are nuclear powers? And does this make the situation much worse than, for example, terrorism and counterstrikes between Israel and Lebanon?
Yes, I think that this is the first time that, you know, we're having a crisis where, well, not the first time, because it happened once before in 2001, 2002. Where a terrorist attack brought the two countries to the brink of nuclear war, and we're looking at that prospect again. So in that respect, no. In terms of comparing it to the Hezbollah-Israeli war of 2006, there are a lot of differences. I mean, Lebanon is a very different country. A weak country dominated by Syria for a very long time, and of course Iran has a tremendous amount of influence. Hence Hezbollah's ability to act as a state within a state. But there are significant differences, one being that Hezbollah is a much more powerful organization than, say, the militant groups that are based out of Pakistan. Hezbollah is part of the state. It has members in parliament. Its armed wing or its militia is far more stronger than the country's military. So in that respect, it's very different. And then, of course, it's a much more complex international situation because you have Iranian and Syrian influence. And, of course, Israel gets involved. So you're looking at a much more wider regional problem. Here we're looking at two countries and the militants as the third party, and of course the United States as trying to be the mediator.
Let's go next to Asak in Fort Worth. Hi, Asak.
Hi, this is Afak Bernie. The question I had was, your guest was talking about short-term and long-term solution, short-term being used force to deal with the immediate problem, and then long-term. To me, it seemed like this is one, you know, this kind of acknowledging this is one problem, one is a short-term solution, one is a long-term. But I don't think that there is a sequence to this thing. Both of them can be going on at the same time, right? Short-term and the long-term going side by side. Why does that has to be short-term first and then the long-term? Why can they not go together?
Thanks for your call.
I agree. I mean, my reference to my use of the words long-term and short-term didn't mean that, you know, nothing's happening right now. I was more talking about emphasis. I mean, the emphasis, once an attack has taken place, and such a large attack, then the emphasis is on making sure that there are no further follow-up attacks, making sure that the threat, the immediate threat, is neutralized. That doesn't mean that whatever work was taking place to address the long-term issues of disaffection and extremism, that they're not happening. They're happening. It's just that they take the back seat while, I mean, you're dealing with the immediate threat at hand. So, yeah, I mean, they both work side by side. It's more of an issue of focus.
Are you willing, Kamran, to speculate about the nature of what's being discussed behind closed doors by diplomatic personnel that might differ in tenor a little bit from the rhetoric we're hearing publicly from all sides involved?
Well, yes. I mean, what we know from our sources is that the Pakistanis are being told behind the doors that, you know, this is something that you cannot avoid anymore. I mean, you have to give in. I mean, in fact, I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if the U.S. officials were saying, you know, we're sick and tired of this because, you know, we have these things on the western border in Afghanistan. We have Al-Qaeda using your territory to stage attacks as far as London. And now, we have this attack. So I think there's a lot of frustration, and that probably is manifesting in the discussions. And the Pakistanis are being told that, you know, if you don't take action, if you don't do something that'll satisfy the Indians, you're looking at airstrikes and we won't be able to help you.
What do you imagine the consequence of all of this is for Afghanistan, which, of course, has its own problems with Pakistan-based terrorists?
Well, one of the key reasons why the transnational element was interested in hitting at India is to create a crisis between India and Pakistan and them getting a breather on the western border. If you have a conflict in which Pakistan is focused on clashes with India on the eastern border, you don't expect them to be dealing with the Taliban and Al-Qaeda on the western border. Clearly, in Pakistan's preference is dealing with India and not Afghanistan. So they get a breather on that end. And if, I mean, that's sort of something that's an opportunity, but a bigger opportunity. And if things play out the way these people are hoping, then you're looking at even a worst-case scenario where, as a result of a conflict with India, Pakistan descends into chaos. The army loses even further control. And these people have a chance to create the conditions in which they can at least control territory. You have to understand that jihadist groups have never come to power by overthrowing a sitting government. The only time that a jihadist movement gained power was when the Taliban came to power in 1996, and there was no government at that point in time in Afghanistan. It was a state of chaos. So that's what they're that's what they're hoping as sort of a best-case scenario in terms of the outcome of these attacks. But at the bare minimum, they'd like to be able to see a conflict on this border so that they can face or at least counter the incoming Obama administration and General Petraeus' strategy to deal with the Taliban problem in Afghanistan.
In the 20 seconds or so we have left, do you expect, Kamran, that this relationship will always be so fragile between between Pakistan and India?
So long as the India and Pakistan, and more specifically Pakistan, remains as we know them. I mean, if there's not a fundamental change in the outlook of Pakistan, one of the problems that the Pakistanis have is that they think that, you know, we have to contain India. We have to make sure that India doesn't become a regional hegemon. Well, that's already happened, and the Pakistan army and their strategic planners are behind the curve. Once they realize that, then perhaps they can walk away from the brink of this disaster.
Kamran Bukhari is, I'm so sorry I have to interrupt you, we're out of time, Director of Middle East Analysis for Stratfor. Thank you so much for spending the hour with us.
Thank you.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.